We'll call the Committee on Corrections, or the Alternative to Corrections, to order. Senator Triplett is here. She had to run upstairs to another thing. She'll be back down in just a minute, but we'll ask the clerk to take the roll.
Senators Leeson.
Here.
Elke.
Here.
Triplett. Representatives Kretschmar. Blassheim.
Here.
Flamin. Ms. Birch.
Here.
Mr. Brownshield. Mr. Croft.
Here.
Mr. Johnston.
Here.
Mr. Laney. Judge McEvers.
Here.
Justice Marion.
Here.
Ms. Olson.
Here.
Dr. Rabe.
Here.
Mr. Trenbeth. Mr. Witt.
I'm guessing that some of the other people are going to be showing up because they didn't call in, so some of them will probably come. So without that, I guess we'll start with the agenda. Are you ready? Do you want to turn that microphone on?
There you go. Good morning.
Thank you.
For the record, I'm Joanne Hazel with the Department of Human Services, and I'm here this morning to provide information in two different areas. One has to do with the collaboration with the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, and second, to share information about several evidence-based treatments that are provided through our regional human service centers. And with that, I will move forward.
Go ahead.
Okay. When we take a look at the interface between the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation and the Department of Human Services, it occurs at multiple levels. First, we have collaboration that occurs at the regional human service centers. We have collaboration that occurs with the state hospital. We have collaboration that occurs with our central office divisions, and then at the executive level. And so I'll be providing some information about how this coordination takes place. You really take a look at it ranging from a person level, the inmate or the person that's been released or on parole and probation, at the program level, and then also at the executive level and policy level. Out at the regional human service centers, released inmates access many services. We have an array of services that are provided. Since many of the released inmates have addiction issues, many of them are participants and outpatient. We have intensive outpatient. We also have a residential level of care. And certainly it all starts with an evaluation process. Almost without exception, our residential services are provided through contracts, and the treatment is provided through the human service centers. So it's really a public-private collaboration in terms of delivery of addiction treatment services. Mental health services would be based on the specific individual's mental health needs, and so we have individual group family therapy that would be specific to the mental health issues that the person is needing to deal with. We have psychiatric and psychological services. Psychiatric would most likely take the form of medication monitoring, medication adjustments, and just assessing whether an individual is in need of medication. Psychological services are provided through a psychologist. We have psychologists at every center. And that is where testing occurs and input into what is the best treatment plan approach. We have case management services, and we have several kinds of case management. One is for individuals that have a serious mental illness, and then we have some limited case management services for people that have addiction disorders. We have case aid services, which we refer to kind of as an extender to our case management system. These are individuals that provide some of the one-on-one support in the community and work in concert with the case manager and in line with the treatment plan. And then we have our sex offender treatment program. At the Regional Human Services, we have 5 out of the 8 centers that provide sex offender treatment and then the related services to the victim as well. And the services that are provided through the human service centers are for low-risk sex offenders. We do provide high-risk sex offender treatment, and I'll talk about that in a moment, but the high-risk sex offender treatment is not provided at the human service centers. Okay, so then I want to talk a little bit about routine collaboration. What I mean by that is that this is just a normal business day. It is routine in terms of how the collaboration occurs between the two agencies. Every regional human service center has what we call an aftercare coordinator. This person is the contact point for integration of the individual back from the penitentiary or any other secure facilities that the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation has. And so they have worked a great deal over the last several years within a release and integration program. And it's been very successful. There was some challenges initially in that when the inmate was released, the connection to the Human Service Center timing-wise was not always the best. And so they've worked really hard. And in fact, in the last year or so, there were a couple situations where the appointment actually happened too soon. The person hadn't really got settled yet. So, but the intent is that the appointment is scheduled so that within a few days of release, they have an appointment at the Human Service Center and are connected with community-based services. The release and integration program is an enhanced process where you have monthly meetings to discuss upcoming releases and discuss previously released inmates. And so you have the case management system and then the Department of Corrections really talking about how are things going, you know, what's working, what needs some adjustments, and also making sure that there are services in queue so that the person can access them in a timely manner. There are many situations where parole and probation, they're coordinating on specific cases. I mean, this is just a routine process to have communication back and forth to identify how things are going. Are there any signs that there are troubles on the horizon, and so that they do in a huge amount of coordination in respect to that. In fact, at North Central Human Service Center up in Minot, the parole and probation officers were actually located at the Human Service Center due to the flood. And I think only in the last month or so they moved back. So that's called close collaboration. We also have reintegration collaboration on a specific case by case. And then also the Human Service Centers provide consultation on non-open cases. Sometimes we get calls from the treatment providers behind the walls wanting to know what and how might the community work with an individual that they're looking at releasing, determining case direction, and determining if a center can indeed meet the needs of the inmate. So those are routine, and then now we'll go to some specialized collaboration efforts that are occurring across the state. And the first one is our through the drug court location, and that varies whether it's an adult or a juvenile drug court. The Human Service Centers provide the treatment staff. And so that treatment person appears in court. They're working with parole and probation and the court system to report out as to how things are going in the treatment world in line with the expectations of the court. Then we have the Reentry and Integration Program in Region 3. This is a unique and specialized effort up in the Lake Region, Devil's Lake area. They have done some remarkable work over the last few years, and now there is a 28-bed reentry program, and that certainly is resulting in referrals to Lake Region Human Service Center. The Lake Region Transition from Prison to Community Advisory Council and Reentry Working Group is another specialized collaboration based on the specific needs in that region. Badlands Human Service Center over in Dickinson has a sex offender treatment team, and probation is a member on that team. So they're directly involved with that treatment program. Some additional specialized collaboration efforts. Now we'll move over to West Central Human Service Center, which is here in Bismarck. They have a number of efforts that are involved with Department of Corrections, and the first one is monthly calls with the state penitentiary, and that's again where they talk about inmates that are due for release and planning for that release and connection of community services. There is a staff member at West Central Human Service Center that's on the screening committee for the Bismarck Transition Center. And what they do is take a look at appropriateness for that level of service. West Central Human Service Center is a pilot site for the Thinking for Change Aftercare Group, and Leanne had talked with you about that, and also her staff in your last meeting provided information on this cognitive behavior therapy, and I believe that that is positioned to start in March. And so the staff at West Central have been trained in that specific behavioral therapy, and it's specific in that it's addressing the criminality of those individuals. And so I would anticipate that we'll be hearing more from Corrections and West Central on how that's going. At Southeast Human Service Center in Fargo, they have the Integrated Dual Disorder Program, and I'll talk more about that in a few minutes when I share with you the evidence-based treatment programs that are being provided. But at Southeast, the probation officer is part of this team and part of that dual disorder program. In the Region 5 area, they have a little different makeup on their sex offender treatment program. It's more of a collaborative, and they have multiple agencies involved, and within that structure, parole and probation are part of that program and actually involved in the direct service that's being provided. Southeast also has monthly calls with the state penitentiary. Then we're going to move to the next level of collaboration, which is the central office divisions and the institutions. First one is transition to community, and this is an initiative spearheaded by the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, and this has been going on for quite a number of years, and they have multiple work groups with different focus, and so we have multiple people within the Department of Human Services that serve on that transition to community effort. Then we have our state review team. This is an initiative out of the Department of Human Services. And the concept behind this team is that despite the hard work that's done at the local and regional level, the reality is that sometimes there are situations that are so complex and difficult that they're pushed up to the state review team. And so members of this review team include corrections, our Children and Family Services Division, which is the child welfare system, mental health substance abuse, we have aging services, we have the Department of Public Instruction, we have our institutions involved, And then we, those are the core members, and then we pull in other members depending on the situation. And so that team is charged with problem solving and identifying if there are system issues, are there policy issues, are there funding issues, and we try to put together a plan to address the needs of that individual. Out of that has come the next collaborative effort, which is our community-based services collaboration. Community-based services is a jointly funded continuous quality assurance effort, and we're partnering with the Division of Juvenile Services, and they are, we have four pilot sites. They are Home on the Range, Prairie Learning Center, Luther Hall in Fargo, and Ruth Myers up in Grand Forks. And it's a data collection quality improvement process for residential levels of care where we can gain better information and the facility can gain better information on how their approach to working with those individuals is going and what areas they need to put together an improvement plan. Prairie Learning Center was our pilot site, and it's really been a good experience, and it not only identifies areas that they need to do some adjusting, but it also is a way for agencies to show what they do very well. And so it's been a win-win situation, and we're adding the psychiatric residential treatment level of care to this quality assurance effort, and that's just beginning to start to add that level of care. Then we have the post-commitment community placements. This is after an individual has gone through the civil commitment program at the North Dakota State Hospital. And DOCR is providing the community supervision, and Department of Human Services provides, this is the high-risk sex offender treatment that I was referring to earlier. And we contract through and with Rural CPC, Counseling Psychiatric Center out of their back east, but they have staff hired in the state. And Rural CPC, if you're wondering, stands for Responsibility, Understanding, Learning, and Experience. They provide high-risk sex offender treatment in a number of states. We've had this contract, I believe, since 2007. Has been very successful. In our last legislative session through Senate Bill 2190, that was the bill that provided the authority of corrections to provide that supervision post-commitment. So we're able to continue the very tight teamwork that really is involved with placement of sex offenders in the community. So we have corrections, we have the treatment provider, we have the individual that does the polygraph. And then we have the victim advocates on the team as well. So they're providing the perspective of the victim and the impact that that person has had on them. And they really tightly monitor that sex offender, and from those different perspectives, they're able to identify if things are continuing to be positive or if there's anything that needs attention. Okay, then again, to continue with the central office divisions and institutions collaboration efforts, we have our Tompkins Rehabilitation Program. That's a residential addiction treatment program that's targeted to incarcerated inmates, and that's done with a contract with Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation that is located in Jamestown. We have our civil commitment program, our secure services at the state hospital. And then now we're in the child welfare system, and we have what we are aware of, the only one in the country where there is a unique and jointly utilized foster care and correctional out-of-home placement system. So both Division of Juvenile Services, County Social Services use the same facilities for out-of-home placements when that's needed. Okay, then we have the executive level, and for the high-risk sex offender treatment program, we have an executive level group. We have quarterly meetings with the agencies involved, including the governor's office, and we take a look at how things are going and just make sure that good communication continues with a very high-risk program. Any questions on collaboration?
First, I'll start.
Okay.
I haven't heard anything about the Northwest Territory or the Northeast in this stuff. Can you help me out?
Sure. That would actually be within the services that all released inmates and the routine collaboration. That happens at all human service centers across the state. The specialized pieces have arisen out of the regional partners wanting to do something in addition to those. So I don't want you to think that because there was no specialized collaboration efforts listed, doesn't mean collaboration isn't occurring. It is occurring on those routine, day-to-day kind of processes.
Okay. Any other questions? Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Hazel, is there anything in the works for early intervention, I guess you would call it, before they become a ward of the state in some way, shape, or form? What I'm talking about is we've charged out criminals locally that have mental health issues. They need some type of service. My only alternative is to send them to the state pen so they get the help they need, which is not the right use of resources, in my opinion. Defense attorneys, you try and prod them to get some help for their client, and they say, well, I'm not a caseworker. Well, no, you're not, but I mean, we've warehoused individuals over a year that had mental health issues that eventually were exonerated because they didn't have the mental capacity to be found guilty. I've got one in there now that obviously has some troubles of some sort, and I have nowhere to go with these people.
Chairman and members of the committee, what I've highlighted today are those that are directly connected with the Department of Corrections. But certainly the services out at the Human Service Centers through their large locations plus their outreach are available for anyone. Now I know that there are some centers that also provide direct services and consultation with the jails as well. So certainly, where is this individual? I mean, what kind of setting are they in?
He's in Valley City in the Barnes County Jail.
Okay.
And if I can expand on that, recently turned 18, comes from a highly dysfunctional family. He's lower functioning. And my understanding is he has to take the initiative to contact the Human Service Center and set up his appointment and so forth, which is pretty tough to do when you're in jail. To me, it's akin of asking a depressed person to snap out of it. I mean, you expect this kid to become responsible and say, here, you have to take your mental health into your own hands and get the help you need, and that's not going to happen.
Chairman and members of the committee, I would always recommend in any of those cases that you contact the Human Service Centers, because we have situations, and it varies certainly from region to region based on how they've worked out, you know, the arrangements, but we have some centers that the jails actually bring the people to the center directly or to their outreach clinic. We have some that have worked out an agreement that if there is enough people in the jail, they actually go to the jail. It really has to do with a number of factors, safety, transportation, manpower, all those kinds of things. But, you know, I certainly understand that unless they're court-ordered, committed, that a person can refuse services. I understand that, but there are certainly ways to assist in the referral and admission process versus leaving it totally up to that individual. Because you're right, you know, he's probably not going to know how to do all that. So I would recommend always contacting the admission or the director out at the Human Service Centers. They can walk through and certainly work with stakeholders in this to work out how best to deal with those kinds of situations. Yeah.
Senator Elke.
Mr. Chairman and Joanne, are there groups and communities, maybe that volunteer groups or churches or anything, that collaborate with any of these activities like reentry programs or anything?
Chairman and members of the committee, I'm aware that at each region there's an interagency council that has multiple members. I believe there's certainly some variation depending on the interest of people and the regions to participate in that. Every region also has what's called a regional council, where they're tasked to review those situations that I was talking about earlier, that bump up to the state review team if they aren't able to identify some solutions. I know many regional human service centers do have interaction with the faith-based community. Certainly that will be dependent on, you know, people's desire to enter into that kind of collaboration. So yes, I can tell you that occurs, but it would vary. We'd have to do some checking to see exactly what the makeup of those groups are in each region.
Okay, thanks.
Senator Triplett.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Hazel, I'm interested particularly in the ones that you labeled as specialized collaboration, and we're discussing, you know, particular programs in the different regions. Have any of those been in place long enough that you would be willing to say that you think they should be expanded statewide, or are they all so specific to the specialized needs of the area that they really are kind of intended for dealing with particularized problems?
Chairman and members of the committee, I would agree with your second comment that they really have arisen because of specific needs in a region, and through conversation and collaboration this has evolved. Each region, however, has collaboration, and so they just kind of morph into something more enhanced if the circumstance needs to go that direction.
If I may continue, Mr. Chairman, I guess I was focusing particularly in my mind on the West Central example of thinking for change, the cognitive behavioral therapy, and you mentioned that that's still fairly new and just kind of getting going. I mean, that one seems like it's sort of a distinct kind of treatment or program, which if it's successful in the first place, in the first place it's being tried, you know, might be a candidate for being expanded statewide. Could you just comment on that?
Yes, Chairman, members of the committee, and Leanne, you can chime in here as well. My understanding that this truly is a pilot, and if the outcomes and the experience shows that it to be a positive service, I would anticipate that we would all be interested in seeing that move to other regions. Leanne, would you agree with that, or?
What kind of timeline would you expect in terms of being able to say whether it's working or not or should be expanded? Is it like a 2 months or 5 years? Just give us an idea.
Chairman and members of the committee, I'm not aware of the timeline and when they would be looking at that. It is tied to that transition to community effort, so I'm anticipating that it would be reviewed when we have some of those meetings. And so I'm not able to put a timeline to it.
Yeah. Further questions? Justice Marion.
Mr. Chairman and Joanne, I'm wondering, you talked about the release and integration programs, and I'm wondering if you're talking about only those offenders that are on probation and parole. So, you know, a lot of these people get released and they are not on probation and parole. Am I correct, it's only probation and parole offenders?
Chairman and Justice Maring and members of the committee, I believe, my understanding of this, that it is specific to probation and parole. But within the conversation with the state penitentiary, they are looking at releases and reintegration to the community. So those conversations would take place because the penitentiary makes those referrals. Obviously, the missing piece there would be the follow-through of the released inmate. You're not going to have that extra person saying, yes, you really do need to follow up with that appointment. So those conversations take place, but it's just a different arrangement because you don't have the parole and probation officer. But those referrals are made. Absolutely, the appointments are set up and it's included in the mix.
And if I could,
continue.
Mr. Chairman, Joanne, can you give us any idea of the numbers we're talking about? Or would that be more appropriately addressed to Leanne?
Chairman and Justice Maring, you're referring to numbers of what?
That are getting referred to you from the DLCR.
The referrals, I would say, would need to come from corrections. We would be able to tell you, of those individuals that we serve, what is their referral source. So if they are referred and don't receive services, there would be a gap in numbers.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else have any questions? Hearing none, thank you very much.
Chairman, did you want me to go on to the next?
I certainly do.
Next, my presentation is focused on evidence-based practices within the Department of Human Services.
For just a moment, and I'm sorry that I didn't make this request earlier, but is it possible that we could get copies of your PowerPoints so that we don't have to take notes as much?
I did have that written down, but I forgot to ask it. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'll email you a copy, and it'll also be attached to the minutes when they're completed, but after the meeting, I'll send a copy to you.
Okay, Joanne.
Evidence-based practices, just to define what I mean by that, are methods of providing services to specific individuals based on their mental health or substance abuse disorder needs that have been proven to result in positive outcomes. Searched, they've been tested to the point and tested in sufficient numbers that they can then say this is truly an evidence-based practice. Because it's broad-based enough and it can be replicated. So that is my definition of evidence-based practices. We have six of them that I'm going to highlight briefly for you this morning and really demonstrate the department's commitment to providing services that are shown to be effective. And, you know, saying that we provide the service is one thing, but fidelity is extremely critical and very difficult in the real world. We work very closely with Dr. Steve Wunderlich out at UND and Neuropsychiatric Research Institute, and we talk frequently about how in a contained clinical trial environment, it's much easier than sometimes, and these are my words, in the messy real world that we all live in. So we spend a lot of time training and assuring that there's fidelity in how these treatment modalities are provided. First is the matrix model. The next one is the dialectical behavioral therapy. trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, motivational interviewing, supported employment, and integrated dual disorder. Starting with the matrix model, this is a model that uses a variety of evidence-based practices, so they're kind of pulling together different practices into one model. And they complement each other in an integrated fashion that can be provided in an outpatient setting. And it's uniquely designed to accommodate the brain damage that occurs by someone's excessive alcohol or other drug use. The origins of the matrix model is actually in the service provision for individuals that have used methamphetamine. There's a great deal of brain damage that can occur, and the part of the brain that's impacted by that drug use will impact a person's ability to problem solve and follow through with things. And so we need to then accommodate our treatment approach based on the part of the brain that's damaged and needs to repair itself. We have all human service centers that provide this model of treatment, and three of them are internationally certified in this model. This is a model that comes out of UCLA, and so we have had UCLA come out and do training. Initially, we have a train-the-trainer model, so we have trainers in the state, and they've come into the state to do monitoring to see that it's being delivered in the way that it was intended to. So out of that, we have three of the centers that are internationally certified. This is also used in the Robinson Recovery Center, Sharehouse in Fargo, which is done through a contract with the Department of Human Services. That program was funded specifically by the legislature to address individuals that needed longer-term residential services and the use of methamphetamine. Okay, next is dialectic behavioral therapy, and this was created for people who are suicidal and struggling with self-harm urges. It's considered to be very effective for people that have borderline personality disorder, and it also is used to treat individuals who struggle with emotions in general. It recently has been modified to be able to be effective on individuals that have substance abuse disorders and also eating disorders. This is an area that we have a great number of staff that are trained or are being trained in it. The state hospital is in the process of forming a learning collaborative of 15 staff over the next 9 months. Actually, I think they're in the middle of that. So when we take a look at all of the 8 human service centers and the institutions, we have about 30 staff that are trained in this method. Trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy is a collaboration that we have with the university system, the Research Institute in Fargo, and mental health agencies, both public and private. Dr. Steve Wunderlich is really the head of this, and he and his staff provide the training and the clinical supervision for this program. It was formed in 2006. We call it the Treatment Collaborative for Traumatized Youth. And out of this, a learning collaborative has been formed. What we mean by a learning collaborative is that we know that one-time trainings are not sufficient for someone to actually implement a treatment method in the way it's intended to. It needs ongoing supervision. So we have ongoing supervisory sessions. People need to hand in and submit tapes of their sessions that they have. and it's a learning collaborative. We have three programs in play right now in the state. The first one is trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, and that's directed for children that are ages 3 to 18, and it is done on an individual basis. So it's the individual and their parents. Then we have SPARKS. If you aren't picking up on this, we have lots of acronyms in the Department of Human Services. SPARKS is structured psychotherapy for adolescents responding to chronic stress. This is a group therapy process, and this is, again, for adolescents, so it's not the younger age children. We just trained staff this last fall in alternatives for families. This is also a cognitive behavioral therapy. It is specifically targeted to individuals that and families that have had abuse and neglect. So we're partnering with County Social Services and Division of Juvenile Services. We do see that the youth that complete these programs are functioning better than they were before this program was provided. And this program and its method of training and service delivery was also published in the Journal of Behavioral Research and Therapy in 2011. So before I go to motivational interviewing, back to the trauma-focused services, there are staff in all regional human service centers that are trained in that, in the first two, and we are just starting to implement the family-based program. Next is motivational interviewing, and actually this is a widely adapted technique. You heard about it actually when Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation talked with you at your last meeting. It is a method of engaging people in a process. It's a method of engaging people in changing the way and the course of their life. In one randomized study, they found that even one session of using this technique, people were more likely to stay in treatment longer than those who did not receive that technique. And one thing that's important to note, that the longer that someone stays in treatment, and it doesn't matter what level of treatment, it can be outpatient, inpatient, whatever, we know that their outcomes are better. If we can keep them in service for at least 3 months, we know that their outcomes are going to be better than someone that doesn't stay in treatment. So it's real important to engage them in the process. Prairie Lands Addiction Technology Transfer Center is providing the training to the staff out at the Human Service Centers. They came and did an initial training, and now we have monthly coaching calls, and staff submit tapes as well for supervision. I think one thing that is consistent over most of these evidence-based practices is that they acknowledge that people that come in for services come in at very different points in their life. Some people over on the left-hand side, they're just thinking about changing. And then you have people that are truly thinking about changing, and then people that are changing. And you have to use different techniques based on where they're at in this stages of change. And then, of course, you have people that have changed, made changes, and they're in maintenance. So these evidence-based practices acknowledge that, and they adjust the approach based on where a person is at. It's not one size fits all, I guess, is one way to say that. So motivational interviewing is very much targeted at people that are pre-contemplative or thinking about change. And we want to move them over into the action stage.
Senator Elke has a question.
Thank you. Joanne, you mentioned that we talked about the motivational interviewing techniques last time. So the folks that are training human services employees in this or other techniques, are they the same folks that are training people that are in corrections? And if not, why wouldn't they be?
Chairman and members of the committee, the areas that, first of all, they're different. They are different people.
But you're working with the same people. I mean, basically, you were talking about how you relate with corrections and how you, mm-hmm. you know.
But we're each then providing something different for that person. So the motivational interviewing in the corrections world would be focusing on compliance with probation requirements, with court orders, that kind of thing. Whereas in the human service world, we're going to be working on the clinical piece and moving them further into the action stage on what they need to deal with their mental health and substance abuse. So they're, while the technique generally is the same, it's applied differently because you're looking at a different relationship that you have with the individual.
Well, I kind of got the impression that it was very similar because they talked about having all employees at corrections right down to the, you know, to the maintenance person or whatever being able to say, good job, you know, you did a good thing, or, you know, maybe you could handle that differently. You know, am I wrong in that?
Chairman and members of the committee, no, I think that that's exactly the intent. I think some of it might have to do with corrections used to or wanting to deal with one set of trainers. The trainers that we work with are actually provided to us by one of our funding sources, and so they specifically work with treatment agencies. They're not in conflict, so.
But there may be a problem there with jailers or law enforcement compared to treatment people, because law enforcement is looking for something to use probably in court or for a crime, where these people are looking at doing something different, I think. And probably your information that you receive while you're doing this is confidential and would not be given to law enforcement, is that right?
Chairman, generally, if we work with an individual, we have releases of information. If they're on parole and probation, there are releases in place. So we certainly have information sharing about how they're doing in the treatment process. Corrections then tells us how they're doing in the supervisory process. So because between the two of us, we might be being told different stories. So we need to address any conflictual information that we're given so they don't slip through.
Ms. Birch.
I don't have a question, but just to expand on what Joanne provided. It's not in conflict. There's many providers that can train on motivational interviewing. We went out for bid. There's some providers that are more comfortable working in a prison setting and have a lot of experience working with criminal offenders, and that's who bid in on when we went out to solicit bids on having someone come in and train our folks on MI. But the techniques are universal. It just depends on how each agency basically decides they're going to push it into their agency.
Ms. Olson.
Joanne, how long have we been doing this process? I mean, when did we start with the motivational interviewing?
Chairman and Carol and members of the committee, I believe that we have been doing this at least 3 years or four with Prairie Lands Addiction transfer center.
Just so I have my head on straight, not everybody that you're dealing with here, though, that you have a assigned something for them, so it's not private what they're telling you. What I'm saying is, I understand that the people that are coming that are under the jurisdiction of the parole and probation, that you they sign a paper for you to be able to release. But do you have other people that aren't under probation and or parole on that? Do you not?
Chairman.
Do you have them sign also?
We always ask and request that people sign releases of information to other people and agencies that they're involved with so that we can coordinate care. But people do refuse to do that. And so if they refuse, or if we don't know that they're working with someone else, which certainly can happen as well, there will not be a release of information, and so we can't share information. Our approach then, because we also have people that are involved with corrections that refuse to sign releases of information. And so then you engage your motivational interviewing to talk to them about what might be the outcome of not signing a release to your probation officer. Because there's results and there's consequences for that kind of thing if we're not able to talk to the probation officer. So, you know, it's a process of moving them through making change in their life. But we cannot.
Not everybody is with parole and probation.
Absolutely, you are correct. Not everybody is with involved with law enforcement.
Oh, Justice Mary.
Mr. Chairman and Joanne, I've got two questions for you. First of all, is the motivational interviewing available for any of our juveniles that are in the criminal justice system? Is it being used at all for juveniles?
Chairman and Justice Merring and members of the committee, this technique is being provided to our staff at all levels. And so it is a technique that is appropriate for any client. And so, yes, those staff that are working with juveniles, they would be receiving training in this technique.
And then, Mr. Chairman,
continue.
My second question, Joanne, is about the trauma-focused CBT. You mentioned that the first two are in all the human service centers right now, but this family-oriented CBT, I don't know what I can't remember what AF stood for. You said it's
alternative family.
Okay, alternative family. Is that, where is that available right now?
Chairman, Justice Merring, and members of the committee, we have six centers that are currently trained and implementing that program. The remaining two have position openings and weren't able to participate in the first training, but the plan is that they will roll that out once they get a staff on board and the training occurs. So ultimately, in the end, we'll have it available at all human service centers.
And are you able to tell me, I mean, is there a timeline on that, when that will be available?
Chairman and members of the committee, I can get back to you on that. I can get the timeline, because it is on a plan for rolling out, so I can get back to you on that.
And if I may just ask
Continue.
One more question, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure I fully understand that program, but is that something that could be available for the participants in our juvenile drug courts, where we see all this dysfunction in the families? Is that something that might be like a wraparound for the entire family?
Chairman, Justice Merring, and members of the committee, I think it would be very effective, because many of those families have exactly what this program is designed to address, the abuse, neglect, many, many trauma events. So,
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. How are we doing?
We're almost done.
Okay, I'm waiting.
Okay. This next slide just talks with you to share that, actually, we've been talking about the fact that this is seen to be an effective practice in corrections as well, and it gives you some citations on that. Supported employment is an evidence-based practice that helps keep people with mental illness find and keep meaningful jobs in the community, and we have implemented the evidence-based version of that in the Fargo area, soon to be in the Jamestown. And we know that people that receive the evidence-based principles of that program have better outcomes. And the outcomes in this would mean they're employed competitively and they're maintaining that job. We have integrated this with our IDDT program at Southeast Human Service Center. And so the employment coach is actually part of their treatment team. So now we're going to go to integrated dual disorder treatment. And we've been working with Ohio, who has a center of excellence for the evidence-based practices, and we've received much training from them over the last 4 years. And I just want to provide you a quote from him. He says, the service teams in North Dakota have been so successful with engaging people in treatment and helping them reduce and manage symptoms of both disorders that it is now developing criteria for discharging people from services. Integrated dual disorder treatment is provided in 2 regions currently, and we're in the process of training and rolling it out across all human service centers. Southeast Human Service Center in Fargo has done this the longest, and so they are the most adept at providing this service, and to the point that they received a champion award out of the University of Ohio this last year. And so Ohio came and they actually presented the award. So let's take a look at what happens within IDDT. This is again individuals that have a serious mental illness and a chronic addiction. So, you know, looking around the committee, in some of your worlds, these are people that come before you. And our entire systems struggle because they're very difficult individuals, and they have many hospitalizations, and they get involved with the criminal justice program, and they interact with all of us, I believe. So the great thing about this program is it shows that people that are involved in this program do function better. They have fewer hospitalizations, they have fewer opportunities to have involvement with the criminal justice system, and they have more housing stability. So I want to show you some outcomes that we have for individuals that have been involved in the Fargo program. The first one is emergency room visits. These are individuals that show up at the emergency room or are taken to the emergency room. And so from the first year to the fourth year, we saw a 29% drop in emergency room admissions, which meant it went from 24 to 17. In terms of psychiatric hospitalization, we had a 90% drop. It went from 97 days during the first year to 10 on the fourth. Long-term psychiatric hospitalization, we saw a 70% drop. And in terms of numbers, it went from 908 hospitalization days to 268. Use of crisis beds, it dropped 40%. That went from 83 to 50. In incarceration days, we had a 98% drop from the first to the fourth year, and that went from 199 incarceration days to 3. So you see the line went down. These at the bottom is 30 months. On the left-hand side is the number of incarceration days. And so you can see that over time, it dropped. It's a very resource-rich, intensive program, but these are individuals that we have found that without that, they will continue cycling through all of our systems. So again, I talked about fidelity earlier, that it has to be provided in a way that is shown to be effective. It just, you just can't do business as usual. So we have people that come in and actually do fidelity reviews. And so on a scale of 1 to 5, 1 meaning there's no evidence of implementation, 5 meaning it's fully implemented as intended. We had a 4.4 on organizational characteristics and a 4.2 on treatment characteristics. So the Fargo team is doing really well. That's my presentation, and I hope you know from this that DHS is very committed to implementing evidence-based treatments and having positive client outcomes. Are there any questions?
I have a question, because I'm going to be asked this. What of all these new systems that we're doing now or that you're doing now, what is the cost of it, and how many more personnel have been put on, and how many more are going to be needed for all of this?
Sure. Chairman and members of the committee, there are many evidence-based programs out, and there are more and more, and research continues. And we are required by our federal funders to implement these as well. So in most cases, we are replacing what we're currently doing with another way of providing services. So it isn't extra or additional staff. It's them doing something differently. So I guess that would be my answer to that.
Well, I hope that's a good answer, because that's what I would have to tell the appropriations people if they ask me questions.
Yeah, you know, I tell the federal agency that monitors us, because you saw, I showed you 6 of them, and that really is the 6 that we focus on. Other states do like 20, and I tell them, North Dakota is into quality, not quantity.
There you go. Any further questions? Mr. Glassheim.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Joanne, my understanding is that a significant number of people in the penitentiary system are Native Americans. Are we set up to do many of these programs relative to Native Americans, or how does that work?
Chairman and members of the committee, all of the human service centers that have tribal land in their catchment area provide outreach on the reservations. So we do, and certainly Native Americans come to our centers as well. So we do put a priority on providing services in a culturally competent manner. And so we do have training on those topics. But it's an ongoing thing that you need to pay attention to, because it's not only Native American, it's other cultures and other approaches that you have to be very sensitive to. So the provision of services, being culturally competent, is a huge issue in human services, and we continue to strive to do that well.
Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It sounds like you have a significant number of programs that are doing good work. In terms of what we're charged with doing is, are there alternatives to incarceration? Are there any gaps that you can see, or things that we need to consider, changes that we need to consider, whether it's a change in program or even additional money, if it's justified? Are there any gaps that we should be looking at?
Chairman and Representative Glassheim and members of the committee, the department actually is currently in the process of doing an analysis on that very thing. The state certainly is experiencing changes in many ways, and so that will impact human services in one way, shape, or form. So we're analyzing that right now.
Thank you.
Further questions? If not, thanks for doing a great job.
Thank you very much.
My golly, Davey has been sitting there so quiet that it's your turn.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dave Crabb and I'm often with the Department of Corrections. I believe the agenda shows that you just wanted an update on the Community Service Supervision Fund that we have, and I have a handout I'll just pass out that gives the current status of that fund. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I believe this fund was actually created, I think, about two biennias ago. And for you can see that this is a report, a PeopleSoft report that was as of December 31st, that shows the current revenues that are going into the fund for the biennium to date, and it's approximately $9,680 at that time. And on the bottom, you can see there's no expenditures, and on the bottom there, I added something to show the beginning cash balance of the fund. That's we ended the biennium 6/30/11, that's what the cash balance was. And then the revenues, you can see the ending cash balance is approximately $12,700 in the fund. We don't have any appropriation authority this biennium to make any payments from that fund. And I don't believe any agency does have appropriation authority to make any payments from that fund. I could be wrong. But I believe that's not the case. So that fund is just going to continue to accumulate the revenues for the biennium until it's addressed at a different point in time, maybe next session. We did make two payments from that fund in the 09-11 biennium. On June 30th, 2010, we made payment of $34,550. And on June 30th, 2011, we made payment of $21,124. Both of those payments went to the Community Corrections Association, and then the association themselves, from my understanding, then made the payments to the individual community, I'm not sure, the community corrections service individual providers that they have. The bill for, you probably talked about this, but the appropriation this time, there's $375,000. Appropriate general funds in OMB's budget that makes payments for the community supervision grants. And those payments, I think, are made once a year, twice a biennium. So I don't have anything else. If you have any specific questions, I'll be more than happy to try to answer them.
I know better than asking a question. I'll have somebody else ask. Anybody else got any questions on Dave? Okay. Thank you, Dave.
Yep, thank you.
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, you got to raise your hand quicker. Representative Glasheim.
What's the thinking in not appropriating the money? It looks to me, if you're raising about $1,800 a month, is some $40,000 raised in the biennium, if that's...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Glasheim, I believe it was an oversight. When we prepared the budget, we didn't prepare it in our budget this time. We made the assumption, or when we talked with OMB, that OMB was going to include that into their budget, and I think it was an oversight when it went through. We had some specific discussions in appropriation committees when they were hearing our budgets about that, and we took the stance that it wasn't appropriate to be in our budget, and they agreed, appropriations committees. And I don't know why, I can't answer as to why no action was taken on that, but we made that aware to the appropriation of committees that that fund was out there and that it was kind of hanging in limbo at the time. So
So next time, who will, if it's not in your budget, it's supposed to be in OMB's?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Glassine, that's my understanding, is that OMB will pick it up next time and then make payments from this fund also, in addition to, I think the language in the appropriation bill for the community, general fund portion of community service grants, that it will be included in OMB's base budget, so.
Thanks.
Further questions? If not?
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. He does such a great job that you just don't have to ask any questions. Okay, we're down to 11:10 in our thing. We're pretty close to being on time even. So we got discussions.
Mr. Chairman, I put these two items, the next two items on the agenda with both of them are actually at the request of Justice Marion, and we did gather some basic information. I can distribute some information first on the money threshold. And Justice Marion, do you want to lead off with some of your thoughts and while I distribute that information? Or?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, I guess at our last meeting I brought up the fact that under the current criminal statute, theft is a Class C felony if the property or services stolen exceed $500 in value. And the maximum penalty for Class C felony is 5 years imprisonment and a fine of $5,000 or both. And I didn't have a chance to see how long it's been since anyone's looked at the amounts for a Class C felony, but my thought was it's been a long time. And for someone convicted of a Class C felony, and again, I'd have to look to maybe some of the statistics from the DOCR, it just appeared to me that you could end up being imprisoned and coming out of prison with a Class C felony for a pretty minimal amount of money that you've stolen, basically. And the Class C felony, I did email to John, is involved in a number of our statutes, I think one of which caught my eye was the misapplication of entrusted property as a Class C felony if the property misapplied exceeds $500 but does not exceed $10,000. So we've got quite a range, and in the last, let's say, 30 years, the $1 in 1973 today has a buying power a lot different. It's almost, we've had almost a 500% inflation. So I thought maybe we might want to recommend that some of these statutes be looked at in light of this fact. Again, I don't, I can't tell this committee today how many people we're incarcerating on low amounts, or the impact of having a C felony on your record in terms of return to incarceration, recidivism rates, or amount of time spent in incarceration for what today would be a pretty minimal amount of money.
Yes. Senator Triplett, didn't we have a bill in judiciary? Oh, you're not on judiciary. I think we had a bill in the judiciary this last session to do exactly that, and it was beat up pretty badly. Mr. Kraft.
Mr. Chairman, you're correct. I did some digging and pulled up the minutes from the September 8th, 2010 Judiciary Committee. And it made it so far as a bill draft to make raises to the thresholds. Yourself, Representative Clemene, and Mr. Kretschmar were all on that committee. And there's really, it just wasn't voted out of committee. There wasn't a whole lot of discussion or what have you as to why. Basically, the comments that I gleaned from it didn't seem to be widely supported by the State's Attorneys Association. That was an interpretation of the committee because nobody showed up to discuss this, this bill draft and so forth.
I think there was some people there that did discuss it, and I think you're right. The State's Attorneys were completely opposed to changing that prices. And I sat on that committee, and I remember that it didn't come out of it. Never got to a form of a bill yet, or it was never given up.
It actually died for lack of a second, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. And I know they were looking at me, and I didn't second it.
Mr. Chairman, the information that I passed on, I just actually dug up last night, and it reflects some of that discussion. Apparently, there was the bill had been distributed to 103 prosecutors, and four responses were received. That three of those didn't feel changes were necessary out of those four. But in this little document here, this is from the Judiciary Committee, it indicates that there were about 20 different statutes. And before I had read this, I pulled up at least that many with some varying amounts. It appears that some statutes have been, you know, written more recently took that $500 amount and used it, where others, other types of similar crimes didn't use it. And if anybody's interested, I have a big stack of paper here with probably many of those 20 things included in there. And just, you know, I included at the end some of the ones that were different, like willful failure to pay child support, Class C felony, but that's an amount of $2,000 or six times the monthly obligation. So there is a bit of variety in the amounts for a Class C felony. Things that are similar theft type offenses but aren't listed under the criminal theft statutes that Justice Marion pointed out. It also includes some unauthorized use of personal identifying information. That's probably a more recent type of statute. And Class C felony is provided in there for a second offense. But what I did is I did a search for all Class C felonies, and I did a search for the $500 amount, and there were a lot more $500 references because of other instances. But I think I caught everything. But anyway, that unauthorized use of personal identifying information is a $1,000 value. So there is a bit of variety in the similar offenses between you know, $500 and up to a few thousand dollars. But I'll, just for your information, I'll pass this pile of paper around, and you know, you can look at it and compare it with what's in that report that passed out, and just include that in your packet of things to read when you're really tired, maybe.
I need two more. You got two more there.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Triplett.
With all due respect to the chair and the prosecutor sitting to my right, if I had been on the Judiciary Committee, I wouldn't necessarily have thought it would have been the prosecutor's call to make this decision. I think a survey of judges, a survey of defense attorneys might have been equally relevant, or maybe all of them. I wouldn't really expect prosecutors as a group to say they'd want to lower it, but you know, they're not the ones who have to decide to pay the bills for the Department of Corrections either. I mean, I think that Justice Merring makes a really good argument that just from the standpoint of costs, we don't want to be seeing people.
And of course, there were other people that testified too, and I remember after Briggs up, you know, I remember the lady that got up and testified in front of us said that if somebody steals $125 from me, that's a heck of a lot of money. And it's going to hurt me a lot more than it's going to hurt him to go to the penitentiary. I remember her very well. So Ms. Birch.
Mr. Chairman and members of the commission, before this was looked at by the Judiciary Committee, it was actually a state's attorney that brought this forward, saying that the levels of for theft types of crimes needed to be looked at. So I don't think there's a lot of consensus amongst you know, the state's attorneys that this is wrong. And I think you will always have the emotional side of things from victims, but the reality is that whether it's a misdemeanor and you go after it or a felony, they'll still collect their funds. But frankly, no one's going to go directly to the penitentiary on a C felony if it's just a theft of property. But they may eventually find their way in because of onerous conditions of probation that they have not complied with. So the fact of the matter is it's not just incarceration, but as Justice Marion indicated, a C felony has huge ramifications for people's ability to succeed in life, and there are studies that show the economic impact, not just to the offender, but to their family and the whole circumference that surrounds that. So I really think that when you're looking at a theft of property, you know, the inflation thing, I think it's about time we looked at upping the levels for B and A misdemeanors and felonies, you know, even just as a starting point, look at the federal levels.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, in addition to the cost to the individual, the cost to the judiciary, and I don't have any numbers on this, but as a judge, I know that as soon as you have someone who's appearing before you as a felony versus a misdemeanor, they're much more likely to request an attorney, court-appointed counsel, so that's an additional cost. Where they may have pled guilty without counsel if it had been at a misdemeanor level, knowing they owe the money and are willing to pay it back, but because there's the felony associated with it, they don't want to take that risk. There's also, so in addition to the court-appointed counsel, that's an additional cost. It's going to require probably several extra hearings, including a preliminary hearing, more court appearances for the individual who's going to miss work, more burden on the court system with more clerks, more attorneys, more judges with the more hearings. So there are those additional costs as well.
Let's remember who the victims are. $100 to a victim might mean a lot more to them than a lot of other things.
Mr. Chairman, you know, the point is, as Ms. Birch just said, that someone being pleading guilty or being found guilty of a misdemeanor can be held responsible to repay the victim and may be more likely to be able to pay if they haven't had to spend so much on attorney's fees and such. So, you know, I think the victims can be made whole, whether someone is pleading to a felony or a misdemeanor. And and truly, you know, pleading to a felony really is life destroying, and that leaves victims in its wake too, including as the judge already said, you know, the larger family structure of the you know, the children of a felon whose father or mother loses their job is as much an innocent victim as the woman who lost $125. So I mean, I think there has to be a balancing of victims here, and I really think $2,000 seems quite minimal as a place to start to hold somebody to the felony standard.
It's also a way to say, don't commit that crime because it is a felony. If it's $100, maybe some people didn't commit the crime because they know it's going to be a felony. So you got those arguments both ways. I can go either way with it. I think there is a deterrence because something's a felony. Representative Kelch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering, if it's felonious, does that require a jail sentence? And, you know, we're having a little problem with room in jails. I'm just asking for information.
No, it's not mandatory jail sentence, no.
Okay.
Ms. Birch.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, it doesn't require a jail sentence, but any one sentence to a felony sentence has to be placed on probation. Mm-hmm. And right now, our numbers are skyrocketing to the roof. And frankly, probation is a high-end correctional resource and should be placed on those offenders that pose a risk to the public. Some of the risk, you know, the I always get a little irritated when the Department of Corrections Parole and Probation Division become a glorified collection agency. In a lot of instances, probation continues to be extended just for the fact of restitution. And, you know, frankly, our officers have more to do than become a glorified collection agency. And I'd like to see actually some of these restitution judgments turned over as a civil judgment so that our officers could actually work with the offenders that are likely to go out and commit more crimes or violent crimes.
Mr. Kelch.
Croft, thank you, Mr. Croft,
I'm sorry.
Well, the reality is, out in the field, many of these felonies are reduced if it's a first offense or something. So it's not like we're out to ruin their lives if the circumstances dictate that they get a second chance. And there's also the law where if they're sentenced to less than 366 days, it becomes a misdemeanor by disposition. You can change the threshold. I don't think it's going to change the reality of what's going on out there in the practice.
Further comments? Just Marion, did you you brought this up? Did you want to make a motion of a bill or anything, or do you want to make any motions at this?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure of the protocol to tell you the truth, but
well, if we're gonna,
but I'd be happy to make a motion. I think it needs to be studied. I think that, and if it would be appropriate, I guess a motion to, would it be to suggest some sort of study?
We can study it further with this group before we do anything else, if that's what you'd like to do, and we can certainly do that. The only time a motion would be in order is if you wanted to make it into a form of a bill. So if you want to just continue to study, we'll put it on the next agenda so we get some more information so we can have some more input on the consequences of the monies.
I guess that would be my position then, would be for us to look at it some more. And I guess as Senator Triplett said, I mean, I think you need to look at it from all perspectives, including the victims, of course.
Okay. We will put it on the next agenda as a discussion time, and maybe get some other people that would be able to come in and give us some more information on it. Ms. Birch.
Mr. Chairman, as part of that, could I suggest that perhaps, because the clerks of court in a lot of jurisdictions are responsible for collecting the restitution on misdemeanors, and it would be nice to get some information on the number of restitution for thefts that they're collecting on, and just the sheer numbers and the impact that theft cases have, not just on the Department of Corrections and felons, but on the misdemeanors and the court process as well.
John is writing, so he'll have it for us next time. Right, John? Okay. Anybody else got anything on this portion of it? Okay, Justin Marion, did you have something else that you want to discuss with us?
Yes, I do. I have another item that came up. I sit on our commission to study racial and ethnic bias in the courts, and we just had a meeting last Friday, and Tom Trendeth is on that committee also, and I know he's not here today, but the discussion concerned what is happening with those individuals who drive and have their licenses suspended and then drive again while their licenses are under suspension. And all of the judges there, Judge Foudy was there, Judge Sona Anderson, and Judge McLeese from up in Minot said that this is a very big problem. And please don't take this as me condoning people driving without with their licenses suspended. But what's happening is that the judges feel that there really needs to be some sort of a safety valve for those people that have, you know, a chronic problem. And apparently it gets to the point where they have their license suspended, they drive again, and pretty soon we have them, you know, incarcerated for driving under suspension. I know there's one gentleman incarcerated right now, I think, up in Minot, just in the jail there, for continuing to drive with his license suspended. And the point was, if there could be some type of provisional license for those people so that they could at least have a license to get to work. In other words, things just start to compound. So you've got these individuals, now they have no license to drive and they can't get to work. And then they lose their jobs and it just gets worse and worse and worse. And they were suggesting that perhaps there could be some sort of provisional license. And Judge Foudy came to me yesterday, and I will just tell you, he just threw this out. And I think he would be happy to come and testify before this committee, too. But he was suggesting that that there may be a provisional license to give to someone who, for example, could demonstrate their sobriety for 12 months, that this restricted license may be like a 12-hour license, like a 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. They'd have to show that they'd gone through treatment, that they had an AA sponsor, that they went through aftercare, maybe a self-declaration that they have been, you know, sober for at least 12 months, but they could at least get a license to get to work and back. He was relaying to me that there are people who actually have lost their licenses for you know, a three-year period of time, who actually have maintained sobriety and they can't even get a provisional license. So it sounds to me, again, I don't have any, you know, numbers for you, like, and all of the judges there, the trial judges, and I don't know if Judge McEvers here has had any experience with this, but they just said they keep seeing these people. It's like a revolving door over and over and over again. And many of them are maintaining sobriety, but there's no way for them to even get a license to go to work, and it just compounds problems, and we end up incarcerating them again. It's kind of, to me, like how we started the drug courts. We have this revolving door. People have a DUS. They have no way to get there to drive, so then they get another DUS, and it just keeps going and going, and pretty soon you've got so many years that you can't get a license, and you have people then driving without insurance. And he also said a lot of these people don't even know how to go and get, once they finally get through, let's say, a three-year suspension, how to go and get their license back. So it sounds to me like it's a real mess in our court system, and we may need to get some of the trial judges that are actually dealing with this to come and speak to it.
Well, there is such a thing as a work permit that they can get, and they can do that now as soon as they get.
Well, it's limited, though. I was going
to
some of the
but
statutes.
That may be something
but,
that we can look at to extend something like, because now we did hand out a deal because I asked John to get the information from all the other states. And so you got a deal here to show you what, oh, we haven't passed it out yet. Okay, so you got a deal from all the other states. Some of the other things you could do, you could take the license off your car. Now, you know, what'll that do to you? How'd you like to do that for your wife? You know, so there's all kinds of things that, I don't know what the answer is, and I'd be more than happy to do anything we can do to clean it up, but
Well, Mr. Chairman, from what Justice Mehring was saying and referring to Judge Foudy's ideas there, it almost sounded like going through the permitting process again, similar to, you know, the new, what you have to do when you have a new permit. You know, you can drive during daylight hours, but you can't have anybody with you, and, you know.
Well, that's kind of like the permit is now, the work permit. You know,
I don't think it limits passengers or anything.
It does.
Does it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Unless it's changed since I got out of the business. So we have a mechanism there. Maybe it's not working properly, and maybe that's what we should work on to see how we could take care of that better.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes,
Mr. Kaufman. I think part of the issue is, my understanding, a work permit is limited to if you've had a DUI or an APC. It's not, I don't think there's an option for getting a work permit after you've had driving under suspension charges or points or anything along that line that you lose your license for. And if the committee wants to study this further, I am aware that Minneapolis does have a pilot program down there on assisting people to become licensed drivers that have the type of issues that Justice Mehring is referring to, and I could get John some information regarding that.
No, I think we should get some more information as much as we can get. I think it's right. We have to do something to get it straightened out a little bit. I remember when the permits first came in, the work permits first came in, and there was a big fight over that even. So it's going to be, maybe we can get some better information or more information for our next meeting on the suspensions of, if you can get that information to John so we can get that. And if we could get the motor vehicle to give us, to come in and talk to us about the work permits. Oh, we got two of them here right now? Well, jump up to the other microphone here.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Linda Butts, and I'm the Deputy Director for Driver and Vehicle Services at the North Dakota Department of Transportation. And I have a few overarching comments based on our conversation with John. We weren't quite sure what role you wanted us to play here today. And then I have with me Glenn Jackson. Glenn is the director of our driver's license division. And so if you have any programmatic questions, how this works, how that works, I'm going to turn it over to Glenn. But based on the conversation that we had with Mr. Bjornson, we actually pulled our statistics to find out what the reality was, because what came to us was that this is a problem, it's clogging the courts, and it's something maybe it's time to actually wrestle with and take a look at. So you'll see in that second paragraph, in 2008 we had 4,450 DUSs or DURs, and by 2011 we're down to 4,073, which is a drop of 377. However, that still doesn't mean that we don't have a problem. And so I think that we appreciated the call from Mr. Bjornson, and the next thing that we did then was to take a look at what how we develop our policies. They're based on statutes, and then we listed about five of them where there are actual references to what we should do and how we should do it. So that would be a good place to begin a discussion, I think, around those particular pieces of statute. I think the other thing that we too have observed, what Justice Mehring discussed, where someone a long, long time ago had a criminal offense, and then it's almost, we've used the term, it's almost like debtor's prison, where they need to get to work, and so they continue to drive under a suspension, they get caught, and it just goes on and on. So I think from our perspective as an agency too, we would welcome being at the table and being with you, with this group. The one thing that we would lay out, the commercial driver's license, it would not be affected because it's
governed by federal rules and regulations, and I think at the end of the day, we're all interested in safety and not putting that person who continually is a DUI back on the road. So that being said, we would welcome the opportunity to be part of the discussion, and if you have any specific programmatic questions, I would turn that over to Glenn. So thank you very much. Questions?
Explain the permits they can get now to us. The work permit type of thing.
Mr. Chairman, currently we review several items. It really ties back to criminal traffic violations, DUS being a criminal traffic violation as well. We have to go back and evaluate what type of violations they have in the previous 36 months. If they have two criminal traffic violations to include the current one, and I think we stated that in the testimony, then we can't issue one. We are limited. A work
that's
permit.
That's the statute now then?
That's correct. A work permit basically is for a 12-hour period for the days of the week necessary for them to get to and from work, medical necessity, food, some personal time, etc. But it is limited to the amount of time that they can drive. Since it is considered a work permit, we do have information from the employer verifying their employment status. We know where they are going to go to work. We know where they live. So they're limited, but they still have the ability to drive. I know I talk with individuals on a very regular basis who they're suspended, and they tell me, I have to drive. I live 20 miles out of town, and I'm a rancher. And I've got to go to town. I have no choice, but you've taken away my license. How am I supposed to get to town? And there's nothing I can do. If there was a way, and I think this is a very good suggestion, if there was a way that we could look at their record and say the only violation in the previous, for example, 12 months is only driving under suspension, or there's no other criminal violations, or there's no activity, so they show that they really have improved, can we then issue a temporary restricted license? But we can't do that right now because of the way the rules are established.
Could we change? We have a good thing going now. If they went to the and went in and did their testing in the morning and the evening, like we did, what's that called again?
That's the 24/7 sobriety program.
Would that satisfy the statute the way it is now, or would we have to change the statute?
No, that would not give us the ability to be flexible.
We would have to change the statute, but if you wouldn't have a problem if we put that in there for that, if they were going through that.
Mr. Chairman, we would like to keep it focused on the issue of DUS and repetitive DUS and not take it into other criminal traffic violations or other criminal activities or anything else. So we would like to keep it focused towards that person that keeps getting DUS, keeps getting DUS, and so we can't give them a permit because they've had three or four, now they've got five or six, and they're suspended until 2075, and there's nothing we can do. Those are the individuals. I think we've got to find a way to get them a permit to drive, but we can't do that right now.
Got any suggestions for us?
Fix it.
That's what I said.
Well,
give us some time.
Yes.
We can come back.
Yes.
How much time do you need?
Well, we don't need a lot of time. But when do you meet again?
If we have a meeting next month, would that be time enough, or do you want to go further?
Middle of the month.
Middle of the month.
Well, I don't know. We haven't even set the date. But if we could, or we can go into May.
Mr. Chairman, if you could give us until the middle of next month, I'm leaving for 3 weeks this Friday. I'm going to Jamaica and having a great vacation away from things where it's warm.
How about if we set you guys up for a May hearing?
May would be perfect.
And then we can go from there. And you can come up with some good ideas of how we can fix this. Justice Marion, is that?
That sounds wonderful. And again, I'd like to... maybe we can get Judge Foudy here to tell you, because his thoughts were, I mentioned the 24/7 program, Mr. Chairman, to him, and there are other issues involved with using a 24/7 program, I think, with this. But so that's why he suggested another way to verify the person's sobriety during this period of time, whatever it may be. I mean, he was suggesting that there be at least a 12-month period of sobriety and then proof of sobriety. And he also suggested no other criminal violations, you know, obviously, in order for someone to be able to apply for this provisional license. Yeah, I think that would be excellent.
Linda, did you?
The only thought that comes to my mind.
Speak in the microphone, would you please?
The thought that comes to my mind, rather than us working in a vacuum, I would suggest that we meet with, is it Judge Fogarty?
Fogarty out of Devil's Lake.
Yeah, and sit down and visit with him, and from his perspective, identify what some of the problems are. And then if we take it from both sides, we probably could come back with a stronger suggestion to you. So if we could get that contact information, we'd appreciate it.
Then you will contact the judge and work something out to bring back to us in May.
Yes, sir, we will.
Judge.
Mr. Chairman, it's been my experience sitting on the bench that many, many of the repeat offenders don't have any alcohol-related crime. So having the 24/7 program and sobriety apply to someone who's driving under suspension was for unpaid traffic tickets doesn't make any sense to me. It'd be expensive and unnecessary to require someone who doesn't have an alcohol issue to have to be a part of a program that it's geared for people with DUIs. But my question, my question is, how long does it generally take if someone has unpaid fines or something of a more administrative matter with the Department of Transportation, how long does it generally take to be reinstated on average? Because what I've been trying to do as a judge, when I have someone appearing before me and they're at the initial appearance for driving under suspension, is continuing it to try allow them to get reinstated, and then the prosecutor is often good enough to reduce that to driving without a valid driver's license, so we avoid the DUS conviction in the first place. But as a judge, I need to know if it's going to take a month or 5 months, or I don't know how long to continue a matter for.
Instead of giving you some information off the cuff, I would prefer to go back and just put together some good information to bring back to you specifically on that issue.
Thank you.
If we could do that.
That would be great if you could do that. Anybody else got any questions of Linda? If not, Mr. Krupp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Jackson, Ms. Butts. At the risk of opening up a can of worms, I guess, I would estimate a good percentage of the people that show up in court for driving under suspension claim that they didn't receive the notice that they were under suspension. And I believe them. That's one of the few times I believe people. And then that starts the snowball. They plead to driving under suspension, and then they don't get it reinstated, and in a small community, our law officers know who they are, and they just keep dinging them and dinging them. And I'm sure you've addressed that issue before. Is that something we want to go back that far and look at that root cause?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Gruff, we mail out thousands of letters all the time. Most of them have my name at the bottom for some reason. And we don't have the ability to send everything out certified mail to make sure we get a copy back. So we go by the presumption that should we mail the letter out within the required time frame, and if we don't get it back in the mail, that the mail was delivered. And I too have heard that position many times, but our position is and has been that if we've mailed it within the required timelines and we don't receive the letter back saying it was undelivered by the post office, that they should have received it. And then we proceed accordingly.
You can address that a little bit in the thing you're making up so that we got it all in black and white.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Anybody else? Senator Triplett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe when you're addressing that, you could indicate how much it might cost in postage and time to do the certified mail. I mean, if you would have to put an extra staff person on to handle that, and you know, just what kind of costs your agency would incur if you were to actually verify delivery?
Okay, anybody else? Got any questions or comments? If not, I'm going to release you guys, and we'll set you guys up for the meeting we'll have in May. And I can tell this group here, I deal with these people a lot with the oil field stuff. They are workers. These guys are workers. Appreciate you coming in. I think maybe we can get something straightened out this way. Okay. Anybody else got anything for the good of the order? Are we done? Too late. We're done.